show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
Yes, I'm looking for omnipresent internet personalities.
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here, your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Technorama. This is the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If this is your first time listening to Technorama, thanks for joining us. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. We appreciate you giving us your time. I'm Craig Stepp, and with me is Chuck Tomasi. And tonight we have a special treat. Continuing our interviewing series, we have a privilege of talking to Robert Scoble. Robert is a blogger, tech evangelist, and author. He is best known for his blog Scobalizer, which came into prominence while working as a technical evangelist at Microsoft. Robert is very accessible to the point where he has his phone number posted on his blog, and that gave us an opportunity to catch up with Robert and talk about all variety of things, including new media, social networks, and where it's all going, and the challenges all this openness has to his personal life.
So, Robert, tell, for those three people in the free world without high bandwidth, can you tell the listener a little bit about yourself?
I've been a blogger for, 8 years now. Before that, I was a journalism student, got a job at a magazine, computer magazine in the Valley, in Silicon Valley. Started doing conferences and for programmers, and that got me into blogging, and that got me a job at NEC, and that got me a job at Microsoft, and that got me started in the video world. And now I'm going around the world and interviewing interesting entrepreneurs and innovators and other people, and putting those up on FastCompany.tv and writing a column for Fast Company magazine and doing my blog.
So what exactly did you do at Microsoft? I kind of got bits and pieces of it, but never was able to connect the dots.
Yeah, I was in the evangelism group, and there's about 1,200 evangelists around the world, and they work with developers to have the developers understand the new technologies that are coming out, and not just understand the technologies, but also work with them personally to make sure that they have everything they need to build stuff for the new technologies coming out. And I
had a vision of evangelism like Jimmy Swaggart or Jim Baker. Hey, sing the praises, brother!
Except instead of selling religion, you're selling technology platforms.
Right? Well, some people think technology is a religion.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Wait until you start a Mac versus PC war again. Yeah.
Oh.
Anyway, so back there we were looking for a way to change Microsoft's perception, and one of the things we noticed was every time we met people face to face, that people would say, you know, you don't seem so evil. We thought you would be a bigger jerk than you are, you know, or something like that. And so we were trying to figure out how to meet more people face-to-face. Well, that's not a scalable model, but we can put up videos, and that's why we started Channel 9, the website there. I went around and interviewed about 500 people at Microsoft and put up videos and started a whole thing, and that sort of led me into what I'm doing now.
Now, I'll tell you, I read on the Wikipedia pretty much what you just said, that, you know, they was changing people's perception a little bit at Microsoft. And for me, I've been in the tech business for a long time, and I always, you know, I liked Microsoft at one point, then I finally got kind of tired of them. But when I started seeing a lot of your videos and things, I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. And you got a kind of back, you know, behind the scenes view of what some people were working on, or, you know, you could see that it put more of a human face on Microsoft. Is that what the feeling you got?
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, by doing video and doing it in an interactive way, it really changed how people perceive Microsoft. Plus, keep in mind, I was writing in a way that a PR person would never do. You know, I would say nice things about Google or Apple, and I would link to people who say Microsoft sucks and stuff like that, and that caused people to go, man, that's a different kind of attitude we're hearing from Microsoft. There's something there, and that's very interesting. Also, when a problem happened, we would, you know, get all the people on the web really fast, within minutes, and get answers for everybody, and that also got people to see us as a different kind of company.
Mm-hmm. And I think that honesty, you know, when you pointed out like what Apple did good or what, you know, whoever else did good besides Microsoft, even though they were competing, you know, that, I mean, let's face facts, and it made it sound like it wasn't exactly a PR stunt, you know, with that kind of honesty. So.
No, that came out of something I learned at, when I helped run a camera store in Silicon Valley, that back then I learned, I memorized each of our prices, and I memorized them twice, once for our store and once for our main competitor. And that way, when the engineers from Silicon Valley came in with a spreadsheet, I would fill in the spreadsheet for both stores and put down both people's prices. And that way, when they went down the street and checked, you know, with the other store, and they would see all the prices were accurate, that told them that I was a authority or credible on the marketplace, and that got me a lot of sales. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said recently, I know you said you went to China, and you said you've been traveling around doing videos and things. And can you tell us a little bit about your China trip?
Yeah, that was pretty incredible. We went to mostly south of China. So we were in Shanghai to meet with a bunch of startups and venture capitalists. We went to Wuxi, which is where Seagate's factory is, and a bunch of other factories. But Seagate makes more than 1 million hard drives a week in its factory and has more than 10,000 people hired there. It's pretty crazy to see the manufacturing capabilities that have happened in these factories. And then we went to, Shenzhen to meet with Liam Casey of PCH, and he's a supply chain manager for tons of big tech companies. And we saw how the supply chain is changing. And, you know, thanks to FedEx and UPS, now they can ship something right from China right to your house. And that dramatically changes the kind of value that they can provide, because they don't need to ship to a distributor anymore, and they can have a direct relationship with the customer right from the factory floor. And in fact, a lot of times when you buy a tech product, you know, let's say you buy an AC power supply for one of your favorite computers, that web page probably is not coming from the computer manufacturer. Probably it's coming from one of these Chinese suppliers or supply chain managers. Mm-hmm. And your order is going straight to a factory in China, your product's being made and then shipped right out from there to your house. And that's pretty interesting to watch. I mean, the scale of the stuff that you just can't imagine. I mean, these places are huge, and they're, you know, shipping out tons of stuff every day. It's just pretty crazy to be on the floor there and watch it.
Yeah, I think I got one of my first iPods came straight from the factory. I saw it where it shipped from, was it somewhere in China, came through Alaska, and it was at my desk. It's pretty amazing.
Yep.
While you were in China, I saw you, you know, pop up on IM, and I've done this before. I don't know if you've noticed my name in particular, but every once in a while I'll see you pop on. I'm like, hey, what's up? just because I know you're so accessible, which leads me to say that you're pretty omnipresent, except for on the internet, except for right now. You said you don't have service, which is a little ironic. Are there times like when your wife is like, will you turn that off? And just,
yeah,
you know,
once in a while.
Yeah.
What kind of service family
just like everybody else. She puts up with a lot more than most people do.
I'm sure. Well, you know, if I'm on my BlackBerry for a few extra minutes, my wife's like, you know, give me the evil eye, and I'm like, I know that he's. How do you tear yourself away? Because you always seem like you're online. You're either streaming something or you're Twittering, or, you know, how do you break away from that?
I don't. I just give in to the addiction.
Just give in.
I mean, today I haven't been online almost since 11 a.m. till almost right now, because I've been out at Facebook, or we were at the San Jose Mercury News and we went to Facebook and we went out to lunch in between there. So I haven't been online very much. I checked my iPhone a couple times in between, but yeah, I'm not on all the time. And certainly I do try to sleep a few hours a night, and I'm not on then. And I usually hang out with the family, and even when I'm hanging out, though, I'm playing with my iPhone. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's not for everybody, and it's not a normal life.
Yeah. Do you find it gets in the way sometimes? Or, I mean, I guess so, right?
Well, I'm traveling so much, and going and seeing people and meeting face to face, that's how I get away from, you know, being in front of a screen.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something I really try to do anymore.
Yeah.
A week on the beach would drive me nuts, I think.
I'm with you there.
You're right.
Just sit and read. The world is going by. Which services do you currently use?
Yeah, what services do I use? I'm almost always on Friendfeed lately, which brings in, I'm watching about 4,000 people there, and interacting with many more times that number of people, because, you know, let's say, like right now on the screen is a post from Tim O'Reilly, actually a Twitter message from Tim O'Reilly that came into Friendfeed, and then people underneath can comment on that item, and it, you know, some of those things, like last night I wrote a message that had 50 tweets or 50 messages within half an hour, which is pretty crazy. So I'm watching Twitter mostly in Friendfeed, but I do go back over to Twitter and sample what's going on over there. I'll always look at my replies every day, or usually multiple times a day. I'm on my iPhone with Friendfeed a lot. I check Facebook once in a while. I'm checking it more lately because I was there today.
Mm-hmm.
I check email. That's something I keep in touch with. I don't answer it all, but I read everybody's email who sends me email. But yeah, lately I've been coming back to Friendfeed, and then of course I'm on WordPress.com, and our video blog is on a Drupal system that was custom built for Task Company.
Hmm. What is it about Friendfeed that turns you on compared to the others?
Well, it's an aggregator, so it aggregates Twitters and blogs and photos and video and
mm-hmm.
you know, upcoming.org. It aggregates about 40 different things together. So that's one thing that's different than like Twitter. Twitter, you only see tweets there, you know, the 140 character messages. Friendfeed, I see the Twitter messages as well as blog posts that, you know, all my friends, or, you know, like Mike Harrington makes, or Tim O'Reilly, as well as photography from, you know, great photographers like Thomas Hawk come in there. And then there's a community, so you can comment, and it's much easier to comment there and comment on people's blogs. So I find that the activity there is much more, much quicker and much more interesting and smarter. And then it's a search engine. So I can add a comment. Let's say I can put some word, you know, I can put my last name on a comment. And then within 20 seconds, I can search on that word and find that comment, it comes back up. So it's a really killer search engine for doing research on what people are talking about a certain topic.
Hmm.
And I use search.twitter.com as well, which works the same way, but search.twitter.com only searches tweets.
Right.
You know, FriendFeed search engine works on all the different data types that are being shoved in there. I mean, the real reason I chose FriendFeed over the other, because there was other aggregators, and there still are, but three of the eight guys who started FriendFeed, one started Gmail, one started Google Maps, and they brought on the guy who started Google Talk, and the designer who designed it did Google Reader and Gmail and Google Calendar and several other things at Google. So it's a superstar team from Google, you know, Google, that left Google and started their own company. And, you know, I've been on it thousands of hours, and it's been down, I think, twice for less than half an hour, I can remember. And the search engine is really interesting. The foundation is interesting, and the community is really interesting. I really love it.
Yeah. Yeah, I love FriendFeed as well, so I'm pretty much stuck on FriendFeed and Twitter.
Yep.
I like you. I kind of flip back and forth.
Yep.
And I like FriendFeed as well. And you know what's funny is you just mentioned about they brought on the guy that did G Talk or Google Talk, and I guess that explains why FriendFeed has an IM bot now.
Yep. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think they're just getting started. I mean, it's only a year old, right? So
yeah.
I think they're just getting started. I think where they're going is a crash course with Facebook. And it'll be very interesting to see where the two go in the future to compete with each other. You know, Facebook obviously has hundreds of employees, and FriendFeed, I think, now has something like 13 or 15 employees.
Mm-hmm.
So they're a little different in scale, and they're in different places in their life, but I don't know. I'm just really happy with what I'm seeing on FriendFeed.
Hi, this is John Bell from Bells in the Battery, along with...
Hi, I'm Ms. Schmackelheimer, Miss Sadie Schmackelheimer.
And you're listening to Technorama.
I'm not saying that.
You gotta say it, it's their slogan.
I don't care.
You've got to say it. That's the whole idea behind doing this.
I'm not saying that, it's stupid.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go.
Get your geek on.
That wasn't so hard, was it? 101.
Look, it's Dean Haglund.
What's going on?
The Adult Show will be on at 11:30.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
I getting drunk with all the engineers from Apple.
I thought I was just wasting my time going off.
They all kind of converge on me and kill me, and everybody's happy. How awesome is that?
That is cool. I love the Apple drunk stories.
I'm thinking,
what the? Yeah. Oh, my, what? This is horrible. You know, my friends that work over JPL said that exact same thing.
They didn't understand a word.
grosser than the Peacock Brothers. You're not thinking that? Huh?
That freaked me out.
We hate you. I'm a dick.
Is that a stretch for you?
What are the challenges with that role?
Why don't you tell me that, guys? How am I coming across here? Complete idiot. Wow, this is really entertaining.
Looking forward, and I know these next couple of questions are probably you get asked a lot, but what services or offerings do you think you would like to see people and startups offer in the near future, or where do you see things going?
Oh man, that's a tough one, because I think right now the whole market is ahead of the users. You know, if you ask a normal person, you know, are you on Twitter? Are you blogging? Are you on Flickr? Are you on YouTube? You know, a normal person in the street.
Are you on crack?
Yeah, my kids put some videos up with YouTube, and I'm blogging. I think I read those. You know, the normal person is still hasn't discovered this world yet. So I'm not looking for too much other than shave the edges off these services so that they become easier to use.
Mm-hmm.
More powerful and more adept for the mainstream user, and protect, you know, the early adopters from the mainstream users, because I've been online and watched online migrations, you know, since the 1980s, and every time the mainstream users come on, the early adopters leave and go and find someplace else to hang out.
Yeah.
And actually, FriendFeed is real interesting from that aspect, because FriendFeed, nobody has the same experience on FriendFeed, right? If you're on FriendFeed right now, you're having a different experience than I am, because I'm watching 4,000 early adopters, and maybe you're only watching 20 people. Well, my screens are going by pretty fast, and your screens will be very slow. But everything in FriendFeed is decentralized. So, and what do I mean by that? One, I have a different experience than you do based on the people I'm following. That's why I say it's much more important to be very choosy about who you're following than to worry about who is following you, right? Who's following you doesn't matter to you really, other than ego, you know, and bragging rights, and say, oh, I got 20,000 followers or whatever. But it really matters. It defines you by who you follow and who you bring into your life and whose exports you want to see come into your life. You know, if you follow idiots, you're going to have quite a different experience than if you follow Nobel Peace Prize winners, right?
He does know our show and our listeners,
Chuck. That's right, yeah, and did we follow each other.
I mean, I follow lots of both, right? So, you know, I mean, on Twitter, people make fun of me for following a lot of people, but I wanted to follow a group of early adopters, and that's how I defined myself, and I didn't define them any differently than that. In fact, when I started noticing that the late adopters started coming into Twitter, I shut off the autofollow and really got much more choosy about who I was following. And on FriendFeed, I'm doing the same kind of thing. I'm adding a few people who probably I wouldn't have added if I was being choosier. But FriendFeed has this thing called lists, so I can have, you know, a wide open room with 4,000 people, and then I have my tech news room where I have people like Mike Arrington in there, and I only have 200 people in that room. And those people were very hand-selected for being high-signal, low-noise kinds of generation people. And it's a totally different experience. You know, you go over to the other room, you see lots of cat photos, lots of jokes, lots of cartoons.
Sales on leather handbags.
Yeah, you know, a celebrity. We haven't seen too much spam yet, and there's a reason. The decentralized nature of FriendFeed, and I'll talk about that in a second, has kept spam out so far, but it's going to come. But what I meant by decentralized, so let's say I write an item in FriendFeed, and then I have 15 people who comment on that item. I can delete any of those comments in FriendFeed. And you can't, right? But if you start an item in FriendFeed, you can delete the comments under your item, and I can't delete them. So we're each a moderator on FriendFeed. The moderation of the, because it's really a web forum, the moderation of the forum has been totally decentralized. That's the first time in history I've seen this, and it totally is keeping spam and assholes at bay quite a bit. It's retarding their move into the forums. Because one thing that happens with forums, and it's happened every time I've seen a new forum type come up online, like, you know, I was on BBS's when my friend had one in his garage. And
rock on,
and,
man!
You know, yeah, eventually the assholes moved in, and it just, you know, and then you moved over to AOL because AOL was new and nobody knew about it. And then the masses joined that. And then you had to move over to CompuServe or Prodigy. And then you had to move over to Usenet, you know. And then Usenet got full of spam and you had to move somewhere else. We haven't had to move yet off of FriendFeed because of this decentralized behavior. Nobody has the same experience on FriendFeed. And therefore, it makes it very hard to attack by people who want to disrupt, you know, a forum, because there's no centralized forum. How can I disrupt everybody's experience on FriendFeed? Yeah. You have to build a lot of friendships. And how do you build a lot of friendships? And then you know, once you do that, that's pretty interesting. And then you're not about to become an asshole and piss everybody off. And get them to follow you. You know?
Yeah, and you know, I haven't really thought about FriendFeed quite like that. But yeah, you're right. Everybody's kind of a moderator, and I follow people that I think are interesting, and of course, vice versa.
Also, they have a block feature. So if you come in and are an asshole, I can block you. And the block means that I can't see you and you can't see me. It totally takes away your power to disrupt my life. And that is huge, because what happens in web forums, you know, forums are always fun when there are four people, or like here, we have three people. We're going to have a fun conversation. We could have a fun conversation for, you know, 2 months, because we'll find something to talk about. We're not going to be assholes to each other, and we're, you know, going to be able to get along. But you start keep adding people into this conversation. First of all, new people will have to come in, and you'll have to explain what we're talking about, you know. And like I was an early participant in the net meeting forums on Microsoft's forum. Mm-hmm. And for the first couple of months, they were fun. They were really fun because everybody was discovering the product together, and we were all playing around with it. We were all calling each other and having a good time. And then, the first wave of newbies came in, and that was still pretty fun because you could teach the newbies all about what was cool. And then the second wave of newbies came in, and it got a little less fun. And then a third wave came in, and it got really a lot less fun.
Are there any girls here?
Yeah, exactly. You know, even if they were trying to be rational, they would ask the same tech support questions we answered to each other a year ago. You know, it's like, this is not any fun anymore. It's work. And we weren't getting paid for it. So eventually the early adopters leave because...
Didn't Microsoft recognize you for doing the net meeting stuff?
Yeah, okay. So you get an MVP award. You get sworn to Microsoft. You get free dinner for, three nights. And you get...
So it did pay.
Okay, those goodies are fun, but... after another year, it gets really old, right? And that hasn't happened yet on FriendFeed. I got people like Tim O'Reilly talking to me, and if anybody comes in and tries to mess with our conversations, I just block them, you know? And
that
everybody figures that out pretty fast, so they get along, you know? And also, they don't know who Tim O'Reilly is. If you don't know who Tim O'Reilly is, there's no reason to try to talk to him, right?
Right.
So you know, you get slowly, you slowly build up your own experience and build up your own list of friends and build up your own little, you know, room. And so far it's working out. Now we'll see in a year if that theory really holds true as it scales up, you know, 100,000 people. But so far it's going pretty good.
Looking ahead, what do you see as the future of new media?
A lot of flow, and we need a lot better filtering. The noise now is that there are so many smart people online that you want to listen to that you can't possibly listen to them anymore. And also, I did a video yesterday about, you know, when I started blogging, conversation would go on for a week. You know, Dave Weiner or somebody like Tim O'Reilly or... would start a conversation and it would bubble along for a week and people would chew on it and really discuss, you know, let's say a new feature in a product that's, you know, let's say Evan listed or something like that. Now the flow is just so staggeringly fast that I call it the half-life of the conversation, that even if you're reading good blogs from really smart people and really meaty stuff, you can't pay more than a few minutes attention to those blogs if you're going to subscribe to more than, you know, 100 feeds. And I'm subscribed to 700 feeds. And on Google Reader, I have something like 500 people who are out there looking for cool feeds for, you know, and are sharing those feeds with me. So I get thousands of things a day to pay attention to. And you just can't chew on them. You can't really, as a community, you know, pick one topic to talk about. The next thing that comes along is within, you know, an hour, and you're off to the races on another topic. And that's really a change that I've seen, and that is going to really dramatically accelerate over the next year as the mainstream starts getting up online. You know, the fact that CNN is doing Twitter casts every day now is bringing a whole nother crowd into Twitter, and they'll discover FriendFeed next year because FriendFeed different than twittering, and solve some of these filtering problems. But we need dramatically better filtering, particularly with the real-time flow. In FriendFeed, there's a feature called real-time. You can click real-time on your browser, and you can watch all the posts go down the screen. And if you have 4,000 people you're listening to, like I do, right now I'm watching it. I'm seeing a new message on my screen every second. And that goes on 24 hours a day, right? So you can't deal with that kind of flow. Most people can't deal with that kind of flow. And it's going to double every 7 or 8 months, right?
Sure.
So if we meet in 6 more months, it'll be two messages every second. If we meet in another 6 months after that, it'll be 4 messages every second or so. And so you need filtering. You need to be able to talk to the database and say, show me all items that mention, Apple and that have 2 or more likes and 2 or more comments, and just show me those. Don't show me anything else because I just can't deal with it anymore.
Yeah.
So that's really what I want. We already have enough tools to publish and get content in the system. I don't see a problem there because I'm seeing a new tweet on my screen every second. I don't think we need to create any more content or make it any easier to create content. Yeah, more tools to filter and find stuff. Well, here's another task, right? The Chinese earthquake, right? Happened how many months ago? Seven months ago?
Right.
Go back and find all the tweets from that evening, from the first three hours that mentioned the word earthquake that evening. You can't do that. You can't talk to the database and say, show me all the tweets on, June 1st from 8 p.m. to midnight that mentioned the word earthquake. There is no database that you can talk to like that. The information's there, right? It's stored on a server somewhere, but getting it back is really difficult.
This is not the set of numbers that you're looking for. 157, 163, 225, 151, 101.
What is that, today's winning lotto numbers from Bruce Barr? Suddenly we've got Dr. Floyd's Imagination Nation Ranger secret message crossing over with Technorama. Does anybody know what's going on in this show anymore? Because I'm lost, and it's our show.
That's the fun part.
Mr. Turtle, how many keystrokes does it take to get to the ring zero center of an operating system, Pop?
I never found out without baiting. Ask Mr. Owl.
Mr. Owl, how many keystrokes does it take to get to the ring zero center of an operating system, Pop?
Let's find out. 1, 2, 3, 3.
How many licks does it take to get to the ring zero center of an operating system, Pop? The world may never know.
Well, let's take a look at your personal life a little bit. Now, I'm not talking about too personal, but personal. Anyway, I've watched a lot of your videos, and I see that you've met a lot of people, and you've mentioned Tim O'Reilly and some other people tonight. I know you've met, like, Steve Wozniak and all this. Who, of all these interesting people that you've met, who's made the biggest impression on you?
Well, Woz made the biggest impression on my career because we became friends, and he loaned he gave me $40,000 worth of Macs for our journalism department in college, and that got me started on this whole crazy trip. So I had to learn how to put them together.
Thanks, Woz.
Well, I mean, he's a great guy. He gives money to every school he goes to, and it's really a great guy. And he is who the books say he is, unlike a lot of other executives in the Valley.
How did you get him to do that, by the way?
Well, I was in journalism class at West Valley Community College in 88, 89, and I kept seeing his car in the parking lot. And what was funny is he parked in the same spot every morning. And he got it turned out he got there at exactly the same time every morning. So you can really see his engineering mind. He really works at simplifying his life and getting all the friction out of his life. In terms of deciding, you know, when to get up and where to go, he's figured that out and he just does it. But I stalked him basically, and finally caught up with him on campus and asked him, "What are you doing here? And can I have an interview?" And he said, "Sure, I'll give you an interview." So I interviewed him. He was taking a Spanish class there and trying to learn Spanish so that he could participate more in his kids' education and teach at the local elementary school. Because one of the skills you needed was to be able to speak multiple languages. So, he was taking Spanish. And then after that interview, we started hanging out. I would be the only one who would recognize him in the school. You know, he'd be sitting right in the middle of the cafeteria with hundreds of students, you know, going around. And nobody knew that the co-founder of Apple was sitting there. Yeah, but I knew who it was, so I'd sit down and talk with him. And one day I said, "You know, I know you get all these new computers because you're like the co-founder of Apple. And, can I get on a list so that if you have an extra one, can you give it to us? Because we're doing a broadsheet newspaper on this little 9-inch Mac, Mac Plus." And we were doing a broadsheet newspaper, so we were doing a lot of scrolling on. And we only have one computer. I was just hoping for a Mac too. It's like whatever you got, we'll take it. And he just went off. He goes, "Oh, I give money to every school I go to, and you should have two." Keep in mind, this was back in '89 when RAM was $450 a megabyte, not a gigabyte.
Yeah, right.
He said, "Oh, you need a whole class of computers, and you need two-page displays, and you need a color scanner." I mean, I hadn't even seen a color scanner. And you need a laser printer, and I'm like, okay. And he said, "Write me up a proposal, and I'll see what I can do." And I wrote down just exactly what he said, and he gave me about half of what he actually said, which taught me a lesson. But, I mean, the half was unbelievable. I mean, we got... I think five computers, back then computers were really expensive. And, with a whole, 16 megabytes of RAM, it was just an outrageous amount of RAM. But yeah, that was a good time to have state of the art computer equipment back in '89.
You remind me of, when I started messing around with desktop publishing, I would print on the laser printer, which had 512K or something. And I had so many elements on the page, I had to delete half of it and reprint it. So I delete half, print it, and then undo, and then delete the other stuff, and then print it on the same piece of paper.
That's exactly why I learned Adobe Illustrator, because I could do more complex illustrations with Adobe Illustrator than I could with any of the other tools, because Illustrator really was... not easy to use back then. It still isn't easy to use, but it really wasn't easy to use back then. It was basically you were drawing things with wires, but because you were drawing them with wires, it was able to take those wires and turn it into PostScript language, and you could build outrageous stuff and print it where nobody in the other programs out there just couldn't print. You would do something outrageous and then you would try to print it even on a really expensive, printer, and they couldn't rip it. I remember that, working in a magazine as a designer, and same kind of thing, you would really have to watch what kind of designs you were making. Otherwise you wouldn't be able to rip them and print them on some of this, old school equipment. Now we don't have those kinds of problems anymore, but we have different kinds of problems.
Yeah, I was using Aldus PageMaker, by the way.
Oh yeah, me too. PageMaker, and I was on the beta for Photoshop, and I learned. So then I got to San Jose State, and they went through the same process. They bought all brand new Macs, and they had no clue how to use them. You know, they just knew that they had to modernize and get into Macs instead of old typesetting equipment. And so, yeah, there I learned Quark Express and got into beta testing multiple master fonts for Adobe, and I was one of the beta testers for Acrobat 1.0 and all that some stuff. And all that experience really, you know, still matters today. You know, it still gives you something to talk about when you go over to Adobe, and it also, you can see where these products came from. So when you see Acrobat.com, you understand the lineage of where they came from and why Acrobat is still a fairly dominant, you know, way to publish today. But anyway, back to answering your original question, who had the biggest impact? I mean, other than Waz, who really, you know, had a huge impact, I would say the most interesting interview or the most interesting person I've met is Doug Engelbart, the guy who invented the mouse and invented windowing systems and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
He is, out of all the people I've interviewed, I think he's really the example of a true visionary, somebody who was not just seeing what was going to happen tomorrow. Like I give you some ideas of what would happen in Frenchfeed maybe a year from now. He was not just a year ahead, because that's pretty easy to do if you really think about things a little bit, but he was 20 years ahead.
Yeah.
And that's mind blowing to be able to see and build a prototype of something that nobody would get for 20 more years. And that he's still like that. You talk to him and he's like, he's 82 and his mind's slower than it, you know, it used to be. And he has trouble, you know, getting out what he's trying to explain to you. But you listen a little bit and you go, man, this guy is whacked. This is a mind that you just don't meet people like that every day. An extraordinary mind that, you know, and I keep looking for other people like that. They're not very many.
Yeah. What? I've seen that video of him demonstrating the mouse and everything. And, you know, that was in 68. I think it's on YouTube, of course. And I was like, wow, you know, you're right. He was totally way ahead of his time.
Yeah. What was mind blowing was he pulled that mouse out of a little Nikon camera lens box and handed it to me and my son. I'm going, what the hell is this doing in your house, man? This belongs in the Smithsonian.
Yes, right.
Yeah. But that was, you know, I mean, just mind-blowing, you know, opportunity. It's not very often you get to meet somebody who has changed the world so much with not just one thing, but a group of things. And he was so ahead of the world that he got kicked out of the research community. The other researchers thought he was too weird.
Oh, wow.
You're talking crazy.
he's actually, if you talk with him, he's a very frustrated person, because he said we could have gotten so much more done if people had understood what these things were going to do, you know, but they just didn't. He said, go back to the 1970s, you know, computers were either these big room-based things that you had to have a college degree just to touch, or they were smaller computers that were used by secretaries to type memos on. And, yeah. And that was it. And everybody back then thought that's how computers were always going to be used. They had no clue that, you know, that the computer that was the size of a room would be on your thumbnail, and that you would have all sorts of stuff like vision and, you know, video conferencing and, you know, all the stuff that we're playing with, but not to mention, you know, something like Facebook. They couldn't even, you know, if you went back and showed them Facebook and a modern laptop computer, they wouldn't know what planet you were from.
You've been watching the Jetsons?
That's just 20 years ago. that's just 20 years, you know, ago, you know, 30 years from now ago.
That's one way to keep the idiots out of Facebook. Keep the computers the size of a basement, and you have to have a college degree to touch them.
Well, yes. They tried to keep Facebook for only the college kids.
That's right.
Then all the riffraff got on it and ruined it. Or so they say.
So I got to ask
way,
you this.
By the way, I was at Facebook today meeting with the head developer over there, and he said they're now processing 100,000 videos a day, and the average length is, I think, a minute and a half. And I'm sure that that's dwarfed by YouTube. I'm sure YouTube has many times more videos. But think about that, 100,000 videos, you know, times, even if it was a minute, that's 100,000 minutes of video every day.
That's a lot of crunching.
That's a lot of crunching, but a lot of content. That gives you an idea of the staggering amount of content that we're generating. And that number's going up. You know, it's not staying flat, right? So a year from now, it'll be 200,000 videos a day. It's crazy.
Well, I got to ask you, still referring to your personal life here a little bit, you know, you seem pretty open and transparent, you know, when you're on the internet. So has that brought any challenges to your personal life?
A few challenges, but a few major opportunities. I mean, you know, when we go to a city, we always have people who want to take us to dinner or hang out with us, or we always have friends, and I've had extraordinary experiences because of my openness. I think I got that from Madonna. I remember hearing Madonna say, exploit yourself before anybody else can. And in fact, in other words, privacy is dead, so give it all away anyways and see what happens. And that's turned out to be pretty prophetic, because today's kids are doing exactly what we're doing. I mean, I'm no more open than an average 20-year-old on Facebook. You know, in fact, I see them being a lot more open with their lives than I am.
Funny you didn't mention MySpace there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so far it hasn't had too many negative. I mean, my phone number is on my blog. I get very few crank calls. Of course, now I'll probably get a couple of them. But, you know, the phone system is a good authentication system. Every time you call somebody, your phone number is on their phone, so they can call you back at 2 in the morning and wake your ass up.
You're right.
Although, you know, I had a geek once who showed me that he could spoof his phone number, which was lots of fun. And what else have I had? You know, I've been on Valley. People like making fun of you and taking pot shots at you, but that's sort of part of what you've bought into. And that's not just aimed at me. That you see that happening with kids. You saw a suicide the other day on Ustream, right? You know, and it was egged on by a group of people. So if there's a downside to it, that is the downside. If you let the audience get to you, they will.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think, you bring up another interesting point, you know, like me and Chuck, we've been pretty genuine and open with our listeners over the last 3.5 years. And, we've actually made some really good friends, you know, and just about any city we go to or any place we needed to go to, there's always somebody there who wants to hang out with us or, you know, whatever. It's a lot of fun. So there's a lot of pluses to opening yourself up.
Absolutely. And like by having a phone number on my blog, the BBC called me at 5 a.m. one morning and said, hey, we need somebody to come on and talk about Bill Gates. And we know, you know, him a little bit, so you're qualified. I said, I'm that not no really good. Qualified. Why don't you call Microsoft PR? And they said, we tried calling Microsoft PR. One, their phone number's on their blog, and two, they're not up yet, and we need you now.
And you're on the phone.
So it always leads into some fun conversations.
Sure, yeah.
Is your whole family techno geeks?
Yeah, Marion's not really, you know, ultra geeky, but she's on Facebook and Twitter now, so. I guess she's geekier than most human beings, but she didn't start out that way. She didn't exactly always want to be part of the geeky world. My son certainly is geeky. He's like the Apple's biggest fanboy.
Yeah, I watched him in line waiting for the iPhone.
Yeah, he knows more about Apple than I think most of the store employees do.
And there you go. There's our interview with Robert Scoble. On behalf of Chuck Tomasi, I want to thank Robert for coming on the show with us and hanging out. We certainly enjoyed talking with him, and we hope you enjoyed listening to it. If you like the show, there are many ways you can show your love. You can call a listener line at 206-222-CHAT. That's 2428. You can email Chuck and I at technorama@chuckchat.com. You can visit the website at chuckchat.com, or there's also a link on there for a donation in the tip jar, one time or a monthly micropayment if you'd like. Or, you know, you can throw a review on iTunes Music Store, Podcast Pick, or Podcast Alley, or any of those other podcasting directories that takes reviews for awesome shows like this. I want to thank Mad Mar for keeping up with the blog on the website at chuckchat.com. And don't forget, this show is a member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com. You can find out more about everybody there at where? Oh yeah, friendsintech.com. We're also a member of Farpoint Media at farpointmedia.net, which is where you can find tons and tons of new shows over there. Tell a friend about Technorama, and until next time, 101.